Welcome to the Authors Who Lead podcast. This podcast is dedicated to you, people who want to be inspired by authors, leaders, and the messages they share. This is such an important podcast to us because we help uncover what goes on behind the scenes when authors are writing their book. We talk about the process. We talk about where they get big ideas, and you can listen in on those conversations. We can't wait for you to join us, so let's get started. Hey everyone, Asul Taronis, your host here of Authors Who Lead. I want to invite this beautiful, wonderful soul, Stacy Tucci's here, an author, a speaker, entrepreneur, and business coach. When she was 18 years old, she started what would become the Academy of Performing Arts in her parents' backyard. By the time she was a junior at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, her small backyard business turned her life upside down, and she incorporated rented space and threw herself into the entrepreneurial dream. And over the next 10 years, she expanded into the custom-built facility and added the second location and grew the Academy of Performing Arts into a seven-figure business, serving thousands of clients. And as people started to approach her about her business, she started to find a new passion to help guiding women entrepreneurs to greater business. We're going to talk more about this and her new book, The Implementation Code, Unlocking the Secrets to Getting It All Done. Thank you so much for being a guest, Stacy.
Hi, Azul. I'm so excited to be here. This is going to be fun.
Yeah. You know, what's really great when I read your book is the advice that I heard from you before when we first met was about outsourcing so much of the things that you don't like, don't want to do, or get lost in. Mm-hmm. And I took your advice. And one of the advice pieces it took was get a social media manager. And I resisted so long. And Oh my gosh, not having to think about that has changed my life. Like literally changed my life.
Yeah. And it's one of those things where if it was already kind of draining and you didn't really like it and you weren't that great at it, but you knew you had to do it, right? Getting those off your plate can just be a game changer. So I'm so excited to hear that. I love that.
It was just it was that simple suggestion. And your book is full of those simple, tactical, easy to take advantage of actionable steps. And one of the things that really struck me was when you started your book, you talked about the perilous idea that you're living small, that somehow you're living the smaller version of yourself and you kind of create a story that this is who you are.
Yeah.
Tell me why that's so important for entrepreneurs. Successful people to think about when they're trying to grow anything bigger than themselves.
Yeah. I think we have an identity that we're attached to. And, you know, even writing my book, I was so nervous to tell people that I was writing a book because my identity was I was a dancer. I was a dance teacher. I was a dance studio owner. I was not an author. I was not a writer. And I think I was attaching to that. So then I played a smaller game and I kind of quietly came out and, you know, did these things. And I mean, like, it just holds you back. I mean, if I would not have been afraid or been okay saying, but by the way, I'm doing this too, right? And played a bigger game, things would just be faster than we are because we just like pull ourselves back. We hold ourselves back with that.
Yeah. And you talked about that in relationship to you've mentioned something about how the role of habits can really change that narrative because that's a little bit about what we're doing the story is attached to the way we perform, show up and behave. And sometimes you said that people in your attach too much to the big picture, which I thought was striking. It's like, what do you mean when you say someone, they really can get attached to the big picture too quickly or too much?
Yeah, there's so many different ways that people take things, right? I can share a strategy and somebody can take it, run with it and have like amazing success. That same piece of advice I can share with somebody else who all of a sudden maybe does attach to the bigger picture and it paralyzes them from even trying or they start to try and they're not getting there. So then they're upset and they're throwing a pity party and they're complaining that they're not getting the results that everybody else is getting, right?
Right.
I remember just recently I had to say to a client, like, you need to give yourself more grace. You are setting these massive goals, not hitting them. And then it just destroys your week. It destroys your productivity. And she's like, but you have high standards too. And I said, yes, I do. But I celebrate even when I don't hit it for my work. I reward myself. I enjoy the journey. Whereas I don't see that person, this client doing that. And I said, you're copying my strategy, but we have very different personalities and it's not working for you. Right?
Right.
So you've got to start to understand who you are, how you are, and what strategies are going to benefit you the most. Like if you're somebody that just needs a little bit, tell me a little bit of what to do and I'll keep doing it and I'll get there. Or if you're like, oh no, I need to see the big vision because if I don't know what I'm really working for, like this isn't going to make sense, right? You have to be very self-aware.
Right. And I think that's the thing I learned in your book. You talked about just this idea of having this all or nothing attitude can be really dangerous. you know, like it's this or nothing, either get it or it's nothing. And tell us why the all or nothing attitude can be dangerous. Cause I really found that fascinating the way you discussed it in your book.
Yeah. The all or nothing attitude, you know, it kind of comes from just watching people personally, right? It's Saturday. You're going to go out tonight. You know, you're going to eat something greasy and deep fried and you're going to have a few drinks. So let's just have the horrible food all day long, right? Like right. we're ruining tonight. Let's ruin the rest of the day, right? People are like, oh, I'll just start on Monday. Well, why can't we just eat healthy all day and then go have that massive meal that isn't good for us, but be okay with not having the all or nothing attitude? So with food and weight and all of that, we've already been doing that, but it's even in our work as well. Mm-hmm. So if there's 6 minutes before your next appointment, it's like, I guess I'll just go on Instagram. You know, like there's not really anything for me to do in 6 minutes. So I'll just like scroll on Instagram. Well, what if you spent 6 minutes diving in and getting that quality work in, but you had 6 minutes here and 7 minutes later and 14 minutes, you know, it starts to add up. And pretty soon that extra hour a day that you found becomes, you know, 7 hours that week. You almost get an entire extra work day than some people are getting. So be very careful with thinking there's not enough time to do that, right? I only have this much time. If you wake up late or something happens, and you do 30-minute workouts, but you only have like 20 minutes before you need to jump in the shower, it is 100% okay to do 20 minutes of that workout and stop. It's right. So much better than just saying, oh, I don't have time, so I won't do it at all. I think that's why we get so paralyzed, is because it's rare that we have all the time in the world to do all the things we want to do, so then we just don't do any of them.
Yeah, that's a great point. I tell a lot of the authors who I coach, I said, I know, want to teach them what their one-minute word count is for writing.
Yeah.
I go, if you don't know, you're going to think that it doesn't matter. You have 8 minutes. And so I make them do a writing test. And my 1 minute word writing count is about 28 words a minute, really pretty standard, not very fast. But if I wrote 8 minutes a day, I could finish a book in a year with 8 minutes a day. So it's the thing, it's this belief that that little bit of time is invaluable that keeps them from being successful. That's why it really resonated with me when you talked about it. And a very similar thing you talked about was the difference between 90 and 365. You talked about breaking your year down, not on having these year goals, but having these 90-day goals. Of course, you're not the first one to talk about it, and hopefully you're not the last, but it is such a beautiful reminder about building your vision around the 90 days or 12 weeks instead of an entire year. Tell us why that's so important and how it works and thinking that way.
Yeah, you know, and I did annual goals for a decade or more before I finally was like, okay, let me try this 90-day thing that everybody's talking about. And I couldn't believe the difference in the outcome. And I think the 90-day process with goal setting, it just has a very different sense of urgency. Okay, what am I going to do today to get closer to this? When you have an annual goal, you're like, well, I mean, if I get to it next month, I'll be fine. And then next month, it's like, I mean, I'm a little busy, but if I got to it in quarter two, right? Like you start to justify. And all of a sudden, what was happening was, I was setting these annual goals, the type of annual goals I was setting, I now started to set as a 90-day goal, and I was finishing them in 90 days. And it was like I started to make 4, you know, rounds of this annual goal planning in 1 year. So I would highly encourage you to ask yourself, what can I do in the next 90 days? Even if you have these annual outcomes, great, but what do you want to do in the next 90 days to get there? And all of a sudden, you'll start to realize, whoa, that is not a 6-month project. I can get this done in 3 months. I can get this done in, you know, however many weeks. So I would encourage you, if you haven't already, to at least try it and see again, your personality. How does it work for you? And do you notice a difference?
That's great. And I realized if I make the amount of goals fewer in those like 3 to 4 instead of a list of 10, then they seem manageable. Keeps my focus.
I keep mine all to 3. I agree with you. I think over 3, you start to get like, how am I going to do this, right? And if you want more than 3, then you just need a bigger team. You can have 12 quarterly goals, but you better have people on your team that can own those goals as well and not just you.
Yeah, that's a great point. And sometimes we create more work for us so that the goal gets pushed farther and farther away. Yeah. I know I've done that to myself multiple times. One of the ways that you discuss this, besides this idea of reframing your brain around how long you can do something, one of the things I do is rather than start my beginning of my year, January 1, with so much going on, I just move the target. Like we start the beginning of our year. If you started like at March or February 1, that's the beginning of your year. You don't have this pressure of like, I didn't make my goals. It's like the holidays are a really difficult time for anything to begin or end. It's just busy with other things. So
like just changing the way you think about something. And one of the ways you said you can change things is by the way you use language. And it's important to have languaging be on target in order for you to think differently. Tell us a little bit about why language is so important in the way you see.
Yeah, I always say to my clients, watch your language. And it's usually when they're like, I can't afford this, or I don't have time for, I'm like, no, watch your language. Like, don't ever use the time excuse, right? Because you're just training your brain to believe this, right? When people tell me they don't have time, or they have this, or they have that, or they, I'm like, no, 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 we all are doing this. We are all in this, right? So I think it's very, how do I say this? Like, even somebody said to me during the pandemic, I think, you know, my best case scenario is we break even this year. I'm like, Whoa. What do you mean? What do you mean your best case scenario is break even? Like, in her mind, that was her best case scenario. And I said, what if your best case scenario was you profited this year? What if it was that you had your best year yet, even in a pandemic? And all of a sudden, I just had her like try that on for a moment and see how that felt. And I said, what would you have to do to really have that happen? And she's like, well, I'd have to do X and I'd have to do Y and we'd have to get this going and that going. And then, and all of a sudden she was like getting excited. I'm like, yeah. What if you went and you started doing all of those things? And this person that we had that conversation with, she's on her way to having her best year yet. But if she would have allowed that language of, yeah, best case scenario is we break even. Oh, she would have been completely right. Like, that's where they would have ended up. And she would have just done what they needed to do to break even and not to be proactive in how do we actually make money? How do we do this?
Right. I completely agree. And the thing about it is for us, even in a pandemic, we've hired more people on our team. We've grown. Made the biggest, best year ever. And it wasn't because we worked even harder. It's just we stayed focused on the language that this isn't scarcity. There isn't scarcity here, this opportunity. Things will change in our life and our business. And I think the thing I learned from you is you just saw the opportunity to be the leader in this shift. And one of the things you talked about, even with, because your business is people in physical spaces together.
Yeah. I mean, when people say, but I was shut down, I'm like, me too. I was closed for 2.5 months back in, you know, March through June.
Yeah. And so I think that some of that reframing is really important.
Yeah.
You talked something really, I thought was fascinating. I have some of my clients do some of this work, which you talked about using this notion of the brain dump. And that one of the things you said that really struck me was that your brain's not meant to store information. It's meant to process it. And I was like, oh, that's such a beautiful way to say that. Mm. It really is the challenge that people have trying to hold on to so much instead of releasing stuff so they can process it and move on. Tell us more about that part. I love that part of the book and I started to really resonate with it. Tell us why that's an important tool.
If you have people on your team, if you have a spouse that you delegate to sometimes, like I get anxiety when I ask my husband to do something and he doesn't write it down. I'm like, whoa, wait, this didn't even happen. We can't even count this interaction because you just like put it in a parking lot in your brain and I have to hope you grab it out there later and you implement, right? So the whole idea here is like to-do lists are your friends, right? Having it written down. So when I'm on a Zoom call with my team and I say something, I need to physically see her pick up a pen or him pick up a pen and start writing because I know that if it's not written down, there is there's a chance that it's just not going to happen. So even you might be thinking this is a trust issue with other people, but it's a trust issue with myself. If I'm in the bathroom in the morning, getting ready for the day and I think of something I have to do, I immediately stop what I'm doing. I'll come into my office or I'll grab a sheet of paper and pen. And I just make a quick little note because again, it's like the chances of remembering something later on that day are very slim because you've got so much stuff stored in your brain and it's personal. It's professional. It's like the kids need dentist appointments. I need to get the oil changed, right? Tell Sarah about this thing. Like you've got all of these things going on. And if you do an initial brain dump and it's like anything you just don't have written down that you need, it's crazy how big these lists are that people come up with on their first initial brain dump.
Yeah. And I love the way you said, because your brain's job is to sort of process and do more complex things. If its job is to store things, it gets a backup. It gets shut down.
Totally.
It's the same amount of brain power to do a lot lower level task assignment.
Definitely.
Yeah. I use Voxer Totally. Put this down somewhere. Put it on a Trello card. I need it out of my head.
Yeah. So one thing that I always tell people I do and they're like, I didn't know you could do that. You can text message yourself. So I will literally text message myself an audio message. So that number one will sit in my text messages until I get back somewhere where I can listen and write it down. So yeah, definitely get a system for yourself of what works. I love that you're using Voxer for that.
Yeah. And you know what else I do? I do text myself sometimes and I'll say, you know, hey Siri, I call myself, well, my kids did this. They put in my phone, they went and called me. Like when I ask Siri, what's my name? She'll say, your name is Azul, but you asked me to call you Fabulous. So I say Fabulous,
I love it.
Text Fabulous and tell them to do this. So I feel like I'm telling somebody else to do it, but it's really
funny. Yeah. I love it.
I love the way you talked about being resourceful, not smart, because I always feel like I have to know everything. Like I have to get the next program, get the next thing. And the way you described it freed up my brain a little bit about I don't have to know everything. Actually, the most successful people aren't the smartest. They're the most resourceful. And you described that sort of idea of who you hang out with, where your circle is. And I think sometimes people, one, don't understand this notion of resourcefulness. So talk about that. But also, how do you evolve? How do you grow out of your circle? What does that look like and feel like practically? Because as you grow, there's times to you realize that your inner circle isn't, and it's time to grow. What does that look like and feel like for you? And how do you do gracefully? Because I want people to understand that this is absolutely essential in order for your business or your goals to be achieved.
Yeah. So I think when you put the pressure on of, I should know this, I should know better, I should have known how to get through a pandemic, I should have known. No, right? That just feels heavy. That will weigh you down. There are so many things I don't know. And if I'm believing that I should know all of the things, I'm just kind of like pulling myself backwards, right? So I don't believe I should know anything that I've never done before. Like, I don't know how to get through a pandemic. I mean, I know how to get through a pandemic now, but I didn't before. You know, March 15th, I had zero clue how to get through a pandemic. Now, after experiencing it for 6 months, okay, I kind of get this. Yeah. I'm getting there. I'm getting better. Things like that, right? So give yourself grace when you haven't done something yet. But then at the same time, I believe that I can learn how to do anything if I want to get good at that thing, right? So when I have a passion for something or something excites me, one of the things that I did for, I live in Wisconsin. So knowing that we may be going into a massive shutdown, you know, in the cold weather, I said to my husband, I am going to take up cross country skiing. And he's like, what? Like that is so out of nowhere. You've never skied in your life and you're just going to all of a sudden start doing this. And it was, my idea was, well, I wanted to be outside. I hate being cold. I heard you get really warm when you're doing this. I'm like, no, I'm going to do it. And I'm committed to learning. I'm committed to figuring it out and I'm committed to just doing it. And I can learn how to do that. And people just look at me and they're like, but how do you know you're going to like it? I'm like, well, because I've decided that I'm going to figure this out. And I think so many times people feel like the unknown, this thing that they aren't sure of, like there's so much more control that somebody else is holding when it's like you are controlling the outcome. You control whether you like that thing or not, or if you want to keep going and figure it out, or if you want to give up. And I think that's where that resourcefulness comes in. I expect my team to be resourceful. I expect myself to be resourceful. I shouldn't be, you know, tagging or voxing or DMing all my team to be figuring out something that I could quickly, easily grab in a second, right? Besides my assistant who is here to do some of those things, there are other people on my team that they need me to be resourceful as much as I need them to be resourceful and go on YouTube or Google something, right?
Yeah. No, that's so great. What about the other half, the part about the growth? So you know, we've heard often about this circle of influence that we have. And if you look around and you are the most maybe smart, successful, however you want to term it, person in the room, how do you gracefully grow into the next circle? One, because you might be uncomfortable going into that next group.
Yeah.
And two, that's true, always. And how do you gracefully let other people know why this is important to you? Because I think that's something that people get stuck in comfortability and they feel bad that they're going to, I don't want to leave this mastermind or leave this coach or help people understand how it's important, why it's important and how to do it.
Yeah. So I think first, who do you want to be, right? Like, what does that look like? Who do you want to be in this moment? Where are we heading? So when you start to say things like, I want to be generous, I want to be resilient, I want to be hardworking, you just name it, right? Ask yourself, the people that you're surrounding yourself with, are they helping you do those things? Or are they actually the opposite of some of those things and they could sway you that direction, right? So when you're thinking about, I want to get healthier. Okay. Well, what kind of friends are you hanging out with? Are they going to be the friend to say, let's go to yoga or let's jump on Zoom and do a virtual workout together? Or are they going to be the friend to be like, you don't need to work out today. Let's go to brunch. Right? Right. So ask yourself, like, who are you hanging out with? And are they helping you be the person you want to be? Now, when you realize there's a few people or maybe a main, like a group of friends that you are needing to step into that, first, there is no big announcement. There is no like, by the way, Azul, you and I, we're breaking up. We are no longer going to hang out. Like, there is no, like, you don't tell anybody. You don't have to say anything, right? But you don't need to, you just don't need to be as consistent or as frequent as you were before. So if you were constantly DMing, texting, calling, inviting, do less of that, right? Right there, that is going to lessen how often you hang around certain people. You might realize, man, that one friend, like, she's amazing, but she's not helping me be who I want to be. You don't have to stop being friends with her, but you may just not want to be friends with him or her on a daily basis where you're talking all of the time. So that's why we say like your top five, right? You can have friends that are bad influences that you love getting together for a girls or guys weekend once a year, right? But if they're your person that you hang out with every weekend or you talk to them every day, they will influence the person you're being. I saw this post on social media that said like, show me your friends and I'll show you your future. Ugh, like if that doesn't get you thinking about where you're going or what you're doing, the people you surround yourself with are major. So now knowing like how to slowly back away from certain relationships, the question is, how do you start to get into some of those other relationships, right? So first, a couple things. Be authentic. Start putting time and energy into making new connections and relationships. Podcasts are a great way to meet people, to talk to somebody for 30 minutes, 45 minutes, and develop a much deeper relationship versus like a DM on Instagram, right? So what are some great ways and systems you can put in place to developing real relationships where you can get to know somebody and then start those conversations? The more you're top of mind, the more you'll get random messages of, hey, we're doing this thing. There's a group of us. Do you want to come, right? You just need to be on top of mind. You need to be, when they're thinking about building this group, again, you need to be the person you want to be so that they think of you when they're trying to enhance their top five or their circle. And I think sometimes too, in the beginning, when I didn't know how to make those connections, a lot of times I was paying to play. I would pay to get into a mastermind where I would apply based off of my background or what I can provide, to pay to get into a room where I can connect and network with somebody at a similar level, right? Now I'm at a place where I have invested and I have made real relationships and real friendships where I can maybe now just DM somebody and say, hey, would you ever want to do a chat? I'd love to get to know you. But because of what I've done in the past, they might be like, you know what? I know who she is. This might be a fun conversation. Let's do it, right? 5 years ago, there's no way I could have done that with most people, right? Yeah. But I put in the time, I put in the money, whether that's like interviewing a podcast or paying to be in a mastermind or showing up at conferences. Like, those are great ways to expand your network.
Right. And I think I learned that early on from Jordan Harbinger, who, when I talked to him and met him, but you know, if you think you're going to dig a well when you need it, it's too late. You know, if you think you're going to reach out to people and be their friends or serve them and then want something from one, that's not very nice or very, very ethical. But two, it's just not the time. It doesn't work out. Like, and I think people that have built businesses by modeling people who, one, have zeros after their name, which I think people do. But then I go, look at what they're doing with their time when they're not doing. Who are they hanging around? Is that who you want to attract? And that brings me to the other point that you make, which I think is really powerful, which is knowing your worth. Knowing what you're worth, meaning what do you want to see as your value? Because it's so easy to take jobs, take clients, take work that isn't at your worth level.
Yeah. Or even a coffee date. Somebody being like, you know what? Can I pick your brain? Let's go to coffee. It's like, I am worth way more than a $5 Starbucks coffee in for an hour chat. Like, there's just no way you could pay me to go take me to Starbucks, right? But if you don't know your worth, you start saying yes to that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So she was someone I was coaching someone. I usually do a little coaching to make sure it's a good fit, because writing a book with someone is a commitment.
Oh yeah.
It's really helpful if they say no, because it saves me time and money overall. But one of them said, when they came back, said, my husband said, this is a really expensive rate. This, he doesn't make this much an hour. And I said, yeah, it's like a Manhattan lawyer's rate. She's like, yeah, I know. And I was like, but I want you to go find a Manhattan lawyer who can help you write a book. Because if you could, you would. And that's not who I am. I'm a premier book coach that these kinds of people come for. So you decide. And they made a decision. I was like, great. Because now we know our worth. I know my worth, and you understand what you're willing to pay, what you're worth. Yeah. So, but it took a while to get there, because I would take anything and everything, right?
Yeah. And I was going to Starbucks, you know, 5 years ago. You could have taken me out for $5.
That's a great point. Cause not only that, but then you're like, I got to get a sitter, you know, I got to drive. Yeah. I've got to stop doing the work I'm doing. That's a great point. And one of my coaches that I've had known, and it was the reason why I'm where I'm at, is Pat Flynn. And I was like, I want to be where he is. And every time he rises, I go, good. I still have the right coach because he keeps rising. Yeah. So this is the person to keep helping me. Serves his audience well. He's committed to being himself. He's committed to family. I was like, yes, this is who I want to be as I'm growing, until that's not true for me. And you talk about this in the book, and then we're going to talk a little bit about the book process before we finish up, is that it's the most dangerous thing to be at the top. Being at the top of anything can be really dangerous. Tell us why it's dangerous.
Oh, man.
The most dangerous place to be.
And a big thing of people not realizing it or being comfortable there. They like it. They like to be the leader, right? A lot of us naturally like to be in charge or like to be the boss. So when you're in a group and you're at the top and everybody's asking you like, oh, Azul, how did you do that? Or how'd you do this? Like, your ego enjoys it a little bit, right?
Yeah.
We don't think, oh, I love this so much, but I want to be at the bottom. that's not a natural instinct. But the dangerous part is, like you said, when you've got somebody who's always one-upping and then you get to keep chasing, right? The danger is when you've got nobody to see that bigger picture, when you are at the top and you don't know what's next or where you could go or what you could do, it's going to take even more brain power from you to have to figure that out. And you may play smaller, right? The studies done about how people just keep beating world record after world record after world record, it's just because it's like now like, oh, wow, that's possible. Perfect. Now that it's possible, let's just get a second faster. And that person does it a second faster, then the next person comes in, right? And people are crushing these records. And it's because we need somebody to show us it's possible, right? That confidence, it will create a very different type of action when it's an unknown. You know, if you didn't have Pat and you were at the top and you've just kind of kept doing your thing, you decide how high you go versus somebody else that's further along. You're like, oh, well, I need to do at least that, right? And all of a sudden, you'll start to see yourself growing at rapid rates.
Right. It is the mindset. It's the way you see things, and which is built into that accountability, expectations of not only now you can see it and believe it, now you have to execute because you know it's possible.
Yeah. Yeah. And one thing too, you know, living in Wisconsin, I am in like the county of Milwaukee. I am in a little country area. It's just a smaller, I don't even know how, smaller mindset, right? Growing up, I didn't know what was possible. You know, even like how big should a house be, or what would be a normal car that you would be driving, or things like that. You go to California and my mind is just blown what people spend on houses or what kind of cars they're driving, or it's just right. Different. And I encourage people, and I still live in Wisconsin. I plan to live in Wisconsin, but I encourage you to like get out of your bubble every once in a while and just like remember what's going on outside of your like little corner where you live.
Right. It's so true. My husband and I, we live most of our life, you know, having traditional jobs.
Yeah.
We raised two teenagers. They're adults now. But the thing that we saw as people traveling the world, we're like, that would be cool if, until we said we can, you know, and we met people now that we admired, like Natalie Sisson, the suitcase entrepreneur, and realized,
you
can do this stuff even at 50. And we traveled the world and lived out of our suitcase for a time. And it was exciting. And, you know, I was like, wow, this is just a belief that I had that you couldn't do this because we had these quote jobs. And so I think it is about that idea of kind of inching your way towards what's possible. And then people see us and go, oh, I would love to do what you do. I'm like, you can if you want.
And I think too, when you want to do something and it seems like crazy, or how would I get there? What I've noticed is before I ever do that thing, I usually have a friend that does that thing, right? So like before I ever thought I could write a book, I had a friend that wrote a book, right? All of a sudden I was like, oh, he wrote a book. Okay, that makes sense. And we're similar. And I think all of a sudden you start to see yourself in certain people. So if you want to start speaking on stages, if you want to, you know, fill in the blank, go start becoming friends with those people. And all of a sudden it'll start to feel so normal, and you'll gain that confidence of, if they can do it, so can I.
Yeah. No, that's so true. Since you talked about your book, let's talk a little about the book process here.
Yeah.
So you got this idea for a book, the implementation coding, you decided to write it. What was the process like for you, and where was the most resistance?
Yeah, the most resistance was I had an idea of what the book process was from doing a book about 5 years ago. And in my mind, I was like, I don't have that much money to spend on a writer. Not that I didn't have it. I didn't want to spend it. And I didn't have a year to write it. And I didn't have all, like, I wrote my first book while I was pregnant. Literally the entire 9 months of being pregnant, I was writing this book in March. So even that idea of like, oh, I don't want to do that. Well, I was in a very different place, right. You know, carrying a baby while I was doing all of this, being exhausted, like all of that. So the hesitation was I thought because I had already done it, I knew what the experience was like. But I think now I can, just like I can say every child is different. I think every book experience, right? I think right. I've heard people say it's like having a baby. It's as hard as giving birth. It's as hard as, you know, doing all of that. Well, each book has been very different. And the way that I wrote it was very different and how long it took and how much I spent and all of that. So that's where I think the hesitation came from.
Yeah. It's that programming. I often tell most authors, the reason you get stuck with this idea of what a book is or how it works is that we were trained to be editors in school, which is, here's the goal. You're going to get A, B, C, here's the rubric, whatever you want to call it, and edit to that success. So people spent their time going, well, I'm an A student, so this is what I need to do, or I'm a B student, or this is what I need to pass the class, rather than thinking about writing as its own endeavor, which is a creative process for learning, growing, and sharing a message. Michael, because you're an editor, all you're thinking about is the end result before you even use the process to actually think about, what am I trying to say here? What would really matter to an audience or to a person I'm trying to write to? How could I help them? I go, that's important. That, in school, that wasn't important. And that's why we sit down and immediately think about the end, because our editor brain kicks in before we even start.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so good.
What was the length of time? Did you write every day? Did you set aside a month? Did you set aside some time every weekend? What was it like for you to do that?
So this time around, I basically took my mornings, and I can write better in the morning. I'm just more open to ideas. Things come to me. So I basically just set aside, you know, an hour every morning to just come in my office and just keep writing. And sometimes I would stop at that hour mark, and sometimes I would just keep going until the kids woke up, and I would just keep doing that. Now, one thing that I did have was I had a writer, an editor, whatever you want to call them, where they gave me deadlines. And that was amazing. Like to have that, get me chapter 1 and 2 by this date, then I want chapter 3 and 4 by this date. I need that accountability. So if you don't have somebody to help you hold yourself accountable and you're going to write a book, it may take you a few years, right? So that part was amazing. This time around, the first time it was more of a ghostwriter. I did acknowledge her in the book. I called her a collaborative writer. She basically pulled everything out of me in an interview type format. I brain dumped things in a Google Doc, you know, gave her my ideas, and she kind of made it like pretty and organized and all of that. This time around, I knew what I wanted to say. I knew that I had to share stories. I had client testimonials. I came way more prepared 5 years in. So this time around, it was just a smoother process because I didn't have to be interviewed. It was like, here's what I want chapter 1 and 2 to look like. Just make it sound good. Like, right. You know, here's all the info. So this book is, when I read it, when I look at that book, I'm like, wow, I really wrote this book. Whereas the first book, I read it and I'm like, man, she's a good storyteller. Or like, she pulled that story out of me. I didn't even know I had it in me, right? So I think the identity shift I had to make was, I'm not a writer. I'm an author. I have a message to share. I have something to say, but I have no idea what grades I got in English, but I am sure they were not good. Like, I am not somebody who is writing.
Right. I love that language shift. I want everyone to hear that. I make my author say, the day one, I say, I want you just to say this out loud with me. I am an author. Mm-hmm. I said, now let all the other preconceived notions go. Authorship has a lot of paths. So don't think that being a writer is the words on the page. Yes. But being an author means you're owning this message. And that's what's most important, because books are really the message you want to share with someone when you can't be in the room with them. That's it. Don't make it more complicated than that. Don't make it more empowered than that. Even when I help TEDx speakers, they like try to give me all this mumbo jumbo. I said, don't forget the simple thing is that ideas worth spreading. It's not how good of a speaker I am competition. And books are very similar. Like, the statistics you even, I think, shared in your book is that most people don't read the books that they want to, that they buy and put them on their nightstand. Most people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so stop thinking so much about the stuff inside. What would you say if someone said, what's this about? And you only had 30 seconds. Think about that. Think about what you would tell Oprah if she said, tell me about your book. What would you say? Mm-hmm. And then what would you want them to take away? Because that's the power of the book. The book is only powerful if somebody else can talk about it. Other than that, it's just like a textbook, and no one runs to the library dumpster and gets textbooks to read to be inspired. They don't. So this has been a wonderful conversation, Stacey. I really appreciate you sharing your truth. The Implementation Code is a powerful book, especially if you're building anything you want to put your heart into and grow. Simple practical strategies. I found it so useful. and I was really inspired. What would be one piece of advice you would give any aspiring leader who wants to be an author and wants to write their truth? What would you tell them?
Yeah, I would say let that fear go of what other people are going to think, what you think about yourself. Like you said, that identity shift of what you think a writer is. But if you have a message, if you have an idea, if you have a story that you want to share, that is your opportunity to take advantage of that and put it out there in the world. I think a book is such a personal way to get to know somebody and just share those stories, like such an intimate way to do that. And they're not going anywhere. Like, people love reading. They love listening to audiobooks and all of that. So I would encourage you to step into that and start.
Awesome. Thanks again. Thanks for being a guest here in Authors Who Lead. We really
appreciate it.
Thank you for listening again to another episode of Authors Who Lead. We appreciate you being here, and we hope you subscribe so you get this delivered to your device every week. And if you haven't left us a review, please do so. It really helps. And if you have a book in your heart, you've been wanting to write a book, please go to authorswholead.com and join us on this journey of becoming a published author.